Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network, hosted by Blog Talk Radio. The Middle Ground looks at today's political issues from left, right, and center. We're always civil and always looking for that middle ground where real conversation begins. You're here tonight with hosts Eric Weiler and Michael Charney. We thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the next hour of The Middle Ground.
This is Michael Charney. Welcome to this hour of The Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network. I'm here tonight to talk about politics and polarization. I believe I have on the phone, Eric, are you with us tonight? So Eric Weiler, my co-host, has had a bit of a conflict, so I apologize on his behalf. But we're
no, I'm here.
You are here, Eric.
I couldn't get the internet to work, so... Did Jessica or Janine, I called both of them like with 2 minutes to spare and said, open up Blog Talk Radio.
Well, we got it sorted out. Janine did dial in, but I was able to come in on the host number.
So, okay, cool.
Apologize for any listeners who were there for a moment or two and to our guest who probably was on hold for a bit as well, Doug Knoll, who we'll be talking to in just a few minutes. Eric, would you like to get us started tonight?
Well, I wanted to ask you, Michael, for your take on this Grover versus Jeb Bush feud going on right now. Essentially, what Grover said, I think, yesterday was, it sounded like a cowboy talking. He said, look, I took out your father when he agreed to raise taxes to balance the budget, and we ain't going to have no balanced budgets around here now. So if you start talking like that, you're going to be walking down the valley of the shadow of death. I took out your daddy, and I'll take you out, too.
Pretty good imitation I've heard him speak, so I don't know if it's an imitation. It's not an imitation of Grover Norquist, but I get the point you're trying to make. Look, Grover Norquist is not on my fan list, not at all. I do not believe that holding anybody hostage in any way, forcing public opinion through tropes like pledges don't work for me at all.
Well, that has nothing to do with public opinion. That's actually circumventing public opinion. It's circumventing this notion of a democratic republic and basically saying, I have enough power to manufacture a revolt against you because I have, I guess, a reasonable number of constituents who are extremely suggestible. And so if you don't follow my ruling class agenda and you try to do something for the people, I'm going to take you out.
Well, I mean, I think we might differ on – I don't think it's a question of public opinion. It may be just what proportion of the public we're talking about. Basically, Grover Norquist has successfully over many, many years planted a meme in the marketplace, and that meme is taxes are bad, and he's made it a black and white issue. He has managed to sound very reasonable and rational. I've seen him, for example, on either The Daily Show or the Colbert Report, with the silent T at the end of both words. And I find myself listening to him going, well, wait a minute, he actually sounds rational, but his behavior doesn't match his rhetoric at all. And I still... I still basically argue that even though it's a small part of public opinion, he has mustered a vocal part of public opinion. I mean, you could argue, Eric, that any successful meme in the marketplace isn't full-on public opinion. I mean, you could even argue that some of our positions about campaign finance reform or tax reform don't necessarily represent the majority.
Well, if I owned all the news channels and I owned all the newspapers and I owned the largest radio networks, I think I could make that case. I don't know that I would necessarily shift public opinion, and I'm not sure that Grover Norquist and the 1% media, you know, the industry that supports that view has necessarily shifted public opinion, but what they can do is basically instill fear in elected officials that if they decided to turn that machinery against a Republican, that they could remove them from office. And so, I mean, to me, I think that the first Bush lost because Ross Perot was a candidate, not because Grover Norquist decided to take him out. But that's sort of the threat. And, you know, the other problem, I think, or the other challenge for, you know, people who want this to be a republic again is that this notion that giving all of our taxpayer money meant for the common good to a few wealthy families and to a few multinational corporations that really don't have tremendous investment in the future of this country somehow is good for everyone. It trickles down. We've made the utilitarian argument. You know, the rising tide lifts all boats. It's good when the rich get more and the rest of us get whatever we get if it trickles down. Now, there's also a utilitarian argument, but it hasn't been on all the news channels. It hasn't been all the newspapers. It hasn't been all the radio networks. But there's a utilitarian argument that actually taking care of the people of the country, not the ruling class, not the super elite, not the multinational corporations that control our government, but the people is good for everyone, because then there's actually the purchasing power among the public, so that, you know, the tide is with the people and the ability to buy the products that our manufacturers make, and that the real secret to job creation is not to give more money to the people who've already made their millions, but to actually instead give opportunity to those people who may one day create companies that make millions.
Well, you've said a lot there. I've always had a lot of difficulty. I shouldn't say always. I have a lot of difficulty with the job creator mythology, and as you do. But I think what's been forgotten is that there was a time when at least a good solid part of it was true. And that was back when we were fundamentally a manufacturing-based economy rather than a service-based economy. And when investment in manufacturing and investment in plants and people really did create jobs and arguably created a large chunk of the middle class. We've attached that story to a different economy, a different class of people who do a different kind of function. I spent a piece of my career, a number of years in it, in which I worked for a company whose basic function was to help other people make more money. People who process money make more money. I worked in the financial services industry. And I was not a trader. I was not a broker. I didn't work for one of the big firms. But I worked for a company that was part of that process. And it is numbing after a while when you realize that money is being used to create more money. And I think that's fundamentally what's changed. What we failed to do is change the narrative. So I think you and I agree on where we're at today. I think you and I agree on, in some ways, about how the tax money that we do collect should be spent. I think I don't agree we should be collecting more tax money, at least not yet. But I don't think, I think all of that is a little bit orthogonal to the positioning of a Grover Norquist and what he does. Grover Norquist's function, as far as I can see, is to feed a polarizing rhetoric by creating black and white out of very gray issues and making it simple for people to misunderstand what they should be taking time to think about with some complexity. That's what irritates me most about that kind of a situation.
Yeah, I mean, it just irritates me that he pushes people around. I mean, Jeb Bush is the kind of Republican that we had when this government could function. When people went to office feeling like their pledge should be to the Constitution and to the United States of America, not to some guy named Grover. I mean, I'm just going to float this theory, and then we will bring on our guest. But I think that it's possible that, you know, people like Jeb Bush end up leaving the Republican Party in this situation. And it's, you know, with the Bush legacy, we're talking about three of them here, right? Grover takes out Dad because he raised taxes, even though Reagan raised taxes 8 or 12 times. But for whatever reason, he decided to take out Dad to prove he's tough. And then the second Bush president, George W. Bush, unfortunately takes up the mantle degree. And then, of course, there's the war in Iraq, that it damages the brand so much that Fox News and the Koch brothers and Dick Armey and other people who are really invested in the Republican Party winning elections feel that they really have to double down on the social issue, conservatism, and essentially populate their news telecasts with all the most extreme and, I think you could say, hateful people in America as essentially a political tactic. And that pushes a lot of good Republicans, a lot of reasonable Republicans, out of the party, or marginalizes them, or silences them, and makes the party look more extreme than it really is. And then, when you have Grover Norquist basically saying, I mean, his position is so ideological that he's essentially saying he is against deficit reduction, and he's against a balanced budget. And to even consider the idea of going back to the tax code that we had when our budget was balanced and when our economy was growing, when our economy was strong during the Clinton era, the idea of going back to those tax rates is somehow, you know, it disqualifies Jeb Bush from being a member of the Republican Party. And, you know, it's just, I think it's what they're using are these bullying tactics because they're losing their grip on an actual consenting public to these kinds of policies that really don't benefit the public. They only benefit a few very wealthy people.
Well, I think they're using, and I'll actually agree with the term here, bullying tactics. I think they're using them because they work, right? So it doesn't make it right. But if we separate the morality and the ethics from it a minute, if kindness and compassion and rationalization and thoughtful conversation actually got votes, that's what people would be doing. They're doing what works. And as long as a Grover Norquist or a Glenn Beck or a Sean Hannity or an Ed Schultz can get people to believe their point of view and believe their simple version of what they see as the truth, then they will continue to promote that. And ultimately what it's going to take is it's going to take a leader, a true leader, who's going to stand up and get enough people behind him to or her to have the clout to make a difference. We saw what happened in the primaries when John Huntsman, who was the candidate, I'm not ashamed to say at all, that I was supporting in the primaries, actually refused to sign Grover Norquist's pledge. And it actually helped him here in the Northeast. It hurt him in many other places where Grover Norquist is popular. But it's going to take a leader. It's going to take someone with some clout, or it's going to take a collection of people through a primary season in the GOP who will together say, I'm not doing this. I'm not going to pander to this level of polarization. Because that's ultimately what it's about. It's about isolating a particular segment pro and a particular segment con. I actually think this is a pretty good segue into bringing our guest on, actually. Any quick comments on that, Eric?
No, that was a good segue.
Okay. All right. I'd like to bring we're talking about politics and polarization tonight. I want to introduce our guest, Doug Knoll. Before I bring him on, I think to say that politics is polarized today is a bit of an understatement. Political posturing, fighting, even infighting, they aren't a creation of current politicians. They have lived throughout history, but it seems with technology, with Twitter, with Facebook, with the nanosecond speed of transmission of ideas, that things have all been turned up, as Spinal Tap would say, to 11. There are a couple of reasons for me that I think this is happening, and I'm very curious to get Doug Knoll's take on this. The first is that we seem to be going through something that I haven't seen before in my lifetime, and I use the term, Eric, a very aggressive term. I call it ideological genocide, and it's not just about proving that the other side is wrong in their beliefs, but it's actually trying to wipe out the justification for even believing it. Like, how can you be human and even believe that, what you believe? And that's a level of ideological warfare that I just don't recall ever seeing in my life. The second is that the money is being used for this. When we talk about money in politics, money isn't, to me, it's only peripherally about electing people, and I actually wrote a blog about this today. The money, to me, is really being used to elect ideas. It's to find a place in our brains that it can set up shop, so that when it comes time to pull the lever or punch the chat or draw in the circle in the voting booth, that we will do so the way they want us to. And that offends me, that money is actually being used to drive ideology and to try to find a place in my brain to set up shop. So with that in mind, I want to introduce Doug Knoll. Doug is the author of a book, an excellent book, by the way, which I read last week, called Elusive Peace: How Modern Diplomatic Strategies Could Better Resolve World Conflicts. Excuse me, I want to get the title of that correct. He is a mediator, professional mediator. He's a peacemaker. He actually became a peacemaker after he left the law, and I find that an interesting, when he and I spoke, I found that an interesting way of putting it. I used to be a lawyer, and now I'm a peacemaker. He's been interested in international mediation efforts for quite a while and has noticed that we often send the wrong people with the wrong skills to do the wrong job, and that may very well be true in the way that we're trying to address polarization of political conversation in our own society. So with that, I believe, Doug, your mic should be live now. Welcome
I'm here.
To the Middle Ground.
Well, thank
Just
you.
Before, you're welcome. Just before we get started, I want to let everyone know that you're welcome to call in. Doug will be taking any questions that you have at area code 646-929-2495, and just press 1 to let us know you're interested in speaking with our guest or with either Eric or myself, and we'll bring you into the conversation. So with that, Doug, welcome, and thank you for being on.
Thank you. Great to be here. Interesting conversation you guys are having.
We've learned how to agreeably disagree. We actually agree.
Civil discourse is a wonderful thing, isn't it?
It is. It is. We haven't figured out how to bottle it and package it, but maybe before this hour is out, you'll tell us how to do that. Maybe we should start by probably introducing the idea of international and political mediation or social mediation. Some of us may be familiar with mediation in a purely legal sense, or you know, in things like divorce proceedings or other kinds of places where we may have been involved with mediators. But on a grand scale, you're talking about something much bigger than that, aren't you?
Right. I am. I am, and I'm not. I mean, I'm really talking about how we take people who would rather shoot each other dead with AK-47s than sit across the table and try to collaborate on a way to solve problems. And what do you do when you're faced with that situation? And how do you talk people in who are extremely polarized, extremely ideological, to the point of extreme violence, and move them to a place where they can actually agree on stuff and maybe even make peace? That's my work. Talking people into doing that, and then helping them do it.
So how is that different from traditional diplomacy? I mean, it sounds like what you just described to me is diplomacy.
Well, it's not. Diplomacy is the art of representation and negotiation of your nation's interests against the interests of other nations. And depending upon your view of international relations theory, whether it's realism or idealism, you see the world as the world stage, the international community as an anarchic system with no control. And the traditional view of international relations is that it's very Hobbesian. So, of course, there are all kinds of flawed underlying assumptions about human nature that go with diplomacy. But diplomats are not particularly trained in negotiation. They're certainly not trained in mediation. and they're not trained in any of the multidisciplinary skills that a modern mediator uses to analyze and then help people resolve conflicts.
So give us a little bit of your own background and how you got into this, and then I want to dig down a little bit and see how this applies to the kinds of...
Yeah, I was a trial lawyer for 22 years, and through a series of events that I won't bore you with, made the decision to try something else, because although I was a very good trial lawyer, extremely successful, I just didn't feel like I was helping people. Too many people were coming out. I was walking them out of the courtroom, and we would get a technical win, but people were still really unhappy, and their conflicts were essentially unresolved. So I stumbled across a new master's degree program being offered at a university near where I live, a master's in peacemaking and conflict studies. And that university happens to be the West Coast Mennonite University, Mennonites being one of the three traditional Protestant peace churches. And so I spent the next couple of years going into an intense study of human conflict and what can be done about it. And as a result of that, I decided that my calling was to help people and serve humanity as a peacemaker rather than as a trial lawyer. So I left the practice of law in 2000, gave up a very successful trial practice, senior partner in a major firm, and opened my doors as a mediator, a peacemaker, and so forth, and has studied conflict from a wide variety of disciplinary perspectives ever since.
So you actually, I believe, one of your major efforts involved working with hardcore, either lifers or hard-term...
Murderers
in a women's prison, I understand?
I'm working in the largest, most violent women's prison in the world, which is located in Central California, teaching women who are serving life sentences without possibility of parole to be peacemakers and mediators in the prison to stop the violence. In fact, this last weekend, I was up there for 3 days taught 35 more women advanced mediation skills. And in the last 2.5 years, they have significantly reduced violence in the prison. I mean, it's been amazing. And so, of course, if we can teach murderers to be effective peacemakers, what's wrong with the rest of us? It's amazing.
That's probably what can you share with us a little bit of how that actually happens?
The project started when my colleague Laurel Coffer, who's a well-known Los Angeles mediator, received a handwritten letter from Susan Russo, who's a woman serving a life sentence without possibility of parole at Valley State Prison for Women, asking if she would be, and the letter was really addressed to Laurel Blind, asking if she would be interested in coming in and teaching a small group of women mediation skills. It turns out that Susan had written 50 letters, handwritten letters, to mediators around California. This was the 50th letter. And it was the last one she had sent out, and she got Laurel's address somehow, I'm not even sure. But Laurel opened the letter, read it, and immediately flipped out her phone and called me and read the letter to me and said, "What do you think?" Because Laurel and I are close colleagues, and I said, "I think we ought to do this if it checks out." So it took us about 6 months to get into the prison, but we started our first training in March of 2010. And since then, we have trained, or our trainers have trained, depending upon the iteration, over 200 women as peacemakers and mediators. We have 15 women now who we are certifying as trainers, all serving life sentences, who are doing training within the prison, and the stories are pretty amazing to hear what they've done. They've stopped riots dead in their tracks. They have mediated some of the most horrible crimes in prison. The women's prison is extremely violent, far more violent than men's prisons. And, you know, it's a real problem. And these women are dealing with it really very effectively. Every kind of conflict you can imagine, racial, religious, ethnic, gender, violent, you name it. It's unbelievable.
I certainly won't minimize the environment of women's prison, but it's arguable that politics can even be more difficult to mediate. Imagine, if you will, we don't have to imagine, actually. We have yet another looming debt ceiling crisis, right?
Right, coming up at the end of the year.
At the end of the year, of course, post-election, they managed to punt that one down the road. And, you know, not surprisingly, the... if the knives are not out of their sheaths yet, they're certainly, you know, we can see glints of blades from both sides about how they're going to take on it. So imagine you've got John Boehner and President Obama in a room. And there's Boehner saying, and of course Cantor's behind it, but you've got John Boehner basically saying, it's not happening unless I get an equivalent amount of cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, in order to get it past the Tea Party caucus, it has to be cuts of, you know, Class A and not cuts of Class B. And you know, President Obama is there saying, well, you know, this is supposed to be routine, and, you know, we can't, and we've already gone down the super committee route, and we've already had sequestration and everything else. How do you approach a situation like that? How should we, as observers of this or as activists hoping to impact that conversation, be involved? What can we do, and how does that conversation ever get settled?
There are multiple levels to the question. Answering the last part first, as activists and engaged citizens, those of us who follow this sort of stuff and have enough intellectual curiosity and concern to pay attention to this instead of watching television. By the way, I don't watch television. I haven't owned a television in 20 years. But so whenever the reality, I mean, my point being that we need to be engaged and say stop. And we do that in November at the ballot box. We need. I mean, Jeb, I'm not a Republican, but I really appreciate what Jeb Bush had to say about Ronald Reagan, and the fact that Grover Norquist slammed him just is, as you both commented, is a really sad commentary on our political establishment. I think the people of the United States, to the extent they can, have got to tell the government, the people they put into office, we're tired of this. The problem is that 49 or 51% of the people in the United States don't care, or they are too intellectually lazy to figure out that we're heading for disaster. And that's a real, and I lay that on the failure of our education system to teach critical thinking skills in the last 20 years. That's the real answer. If I were called in to facilitate some sort of conversation between Boehner and Obama, the first thing you got to know is these guys have a good personal relationship. Cantor doesn't have a good relationship with Obama, but Boehner does. I mean, these guys get along. The problem isn't with Boehner and Obama. It's with their constituent groups, for example, the Tea Party people, the radical right, and the radical left on Obama's side. And that's where all the conflict is. These guys can make all kinds of deals, but their problem is that they're like surfers. If they get too far out on the wave, they're going to lose the support of the water and take a crash and have 50 billion tons of water crashing down on top of them. So their constraints are not between themselves personally. Their constraints are with their constituencies and stakeholder groups that they've got to keep together. And
so
that's a real problem.
That becomes very interesting then, because basically we have essentially a multi-level or a layered conflict, right?
And that's the way all complex conflicts are. This is no different than, for example, the Syrian conflict. Same exact dynamics. Different situation, different context. But if you sit back and abstract the conflict out, you see the same dynamics. And it repeats itself all over the world.
Okay.
And it repeats itself in the California legislature, in the Central California political scene, as well as in Washington, D.C. You see the same stuff over and over again.
And it plays out in every conversation all over the web as well. You can look at the comments that go into any particular article, and or that follow any particular article. The situation we had with the Secretary of Commerce, you know, over the last couple of days, and the comments under the articles were in fact more telling and more revealing about the underlying conflict in our underlying polarization than anything that was coming out in the news. I know Eric is looking to jump in here. I want to just take a minute and remind our callers that they're welcome to call in. It's area code 646-929-2495. We're talking with Doug Knoll, the author of Elusive Peace: How Modern Diplomatic Strategies Could Better Resolve World Conflicts, and you're listening to The Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network. So please call in, press 1 if you're interested in speaking with us or our guest. Thanks very much. Eric?
Hi, Doug. Thanks very much for being on our show. I refer to the debt ceiling crisis as the debt ceiling hostage crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, well, first of all, you know, you and Michael are both very good at the kind of engagement that leads to compromise. Do you think I shouldn't use that term?
No. Compromise. Well, you know, compromise is one way of getting a deal done, but you can also, it's amazing how you can collaborate to get a deal done using integrative negotiation techniques. You can actually create deeper understanding through narrative processes. I mean, there are a million different tools that can be used in these kinds of polarized circumstances. The problem is that our political leaders don't have a clue about how to do any of that stuff. They just don't have any skills. Their skills are extremely primitive. When you watch this play out in the press, I'm just appalled by the how really, really primitive the negotiation and skills of these people are. Kindergarten.
Well, you know, last night we did an entire show about comparing professional wrestling to the way that the political theater that unfortunately so many Americans think is our deliberative process plays out on really all the cable news channels, but we especially focused on Fox News because the tactics so closely mirror professional wrestling. And one thing we didn't talk about enough yesterday was the audience, you know, the people in the arena who respond when, you know, the bad guys lift up a chair and brain the good guy when the referee isn't looking, and, you know, all of the people who respond, and many of them, I think, understand that it's all theater. But if you're stuck in the arena and that's the only thing that they put on the lighted mat at the center, then, I mean, it is pretty natural to choose sides.
Sure, absolutely. And so how do you teach people who are sitting in that auditorium or gym or whatever watching this staged crazy fight that to use some perceptiveness and discernment and start asking some questions, say, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. This can't be real, based on my own common sense. And, you know, so the challenge is getting people to really think about what they're seeing. And that's hard, because our educational system has failed to produce critical thinkers. And that's a big issue.
But that's a potentially a longer term solution, and I can't tell you, Doug, how much I agree with your statement. I have argued that that education should be in our country should be viewed as a component of national defense, and that if you as someone with conservative leanings, I have some liberal leanings as well, but on these issues, some conservative leanings, I do believe that. I would like to see our fundamental way of life here in America preserved, perhaps adjusted in many ways, but preserved. And the fastest way to destroy a way of life is just to raise a generation of stupid kids. I mean,
right. And that's essentially what we've got.
Blunt than that, right? But that's the long-term solution. So education reform, yet another form of reform, education improvement, educational and critical thinking skills somehow built into not just our school system, but our national conversations. But that doesn't help us, for the next 10 seasons.
No, it doesn't. And so what we need to do is inject critical. We need to find people who are critical thinkers, who can be good policy advisors, who are able to skillfully lead these primitive negotiators to a place that's not going to be disastrous. And that's difficult because, when you're an ideologue, you only surround yourself with people who think like you do and people who have the skill to be able to help ask the right questions, which is really all about asking questions and getting people to really think about what they're doing, are few and far between and difficult to get into the centers of power. It's a real challenge.
Well, that brings up something that you wrote about in your book that I wanted to dig into a little bit more. You talk about confirmation bias.
Right.
And at the opening of the hour, or the opening of our segment here, I talked a little bit about how I think the real purpose of money seems to be to get me to believe certain things. And the actions that follow from that are all convenient for those people who have gotten me to believe. But the money is really about changing the way I think, essentially establishing that idea of that they want me to have, building in a confirmation bias. So can you explain for the listeners a little bit about what confirmation bias is, and then how do we overcome it? Because I think once you explain it, everybody will realize that's what's happening.
So confirmation bias is the tendency of, I'm going to use the words of Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman, it's confirmation bias is the tendency of our system one brain. That's our unconscious, automatic thought, decision-making, thinking process, not our executive function of our brain. It's the tendency of our automatic part of our brain to, when it is looking to answer a question, to only look for evidence that confirms the statement that we're seeking to prove is true. So if I say, if the question is asked, is the sky blue, I'm going to look around. My system one brain, the automatic part of my brain, is only capable of looking for information that supports the proposition that the sky is blue. And it will ignore all information that is contrary to evidence that confirms the proposition we are seeking to prove is correct.
That's
now, the way we get around that is we have executive function, rational, what we could call rational thinking or executive thinking, which is slow, deliberate, effortful, painful thinking that says, nope, that's not right. We got to go look for other kinds of information. But unless you train that part of the brain tends to be lazy, and so we get sucked into looking only for information that confirms the proposition that is presented to us. And so we have this horrible, it's called a confirmation bias, because we tend to look for information that confirms our beliefs rather than looking at the totality of the circumstances and making sure that the information we're looking at is all the information there, and we're properly balancing information that is contradictory as well as that information which is confirmatory. And it's an inherent bias in every human being. You cannot not have this bias. That's one of the many, many cognitive biases that we have to deal with. But it is, you know, rears its ugly head in things like politics and belief structures, and creates real barriers to understanding.
Yeah, I think it's probably important to point out that confirmation bias is not inherently a bad thing.
No, it's highly adaptive.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if it makes more sense, the example comes from, I think it was a book called The Believing Brain by Michael Shermer, where he basically says if I hear, you know, if I'm 200,000 years ago, I'm a pre-ancestor, and I hear a rustling in the savanna, my confirmation bias of believing that that's dangerous is beneficial to me.
Absolutely. All of these cognitive biases we have a strong evolutionary adaptive purpose, which is why we have them.
Right.
I mean, we're the products of hominids hundreds of thousands of years ago who got weaned out of the gene pool, cleaned out of the gene pool, because they didn't have this stuff.
Right.
But the problem is that we have brains that were designed for an environment that existed 15,000 years ago, not a highly complex, deeply interrelated, communication-intense, information-dense environment, highly dense social environment that we exist in today. Our brains are poorly adapted to this sort of environment.
Well, I wanted to bring up another very hotly contested issue, and that is voter suppression. And once again, I'll draw upon my professional wrestling analogy. When the arena full of people sees the bad guy pull out the brass knuckles when the referee isn't looking, of course they spend their energy saying, "Turn around, you idiot, turn around." But it's never in time. The referee is, you know, he sort of has that special way of looking the wrong way, like a waitress does when she doesn't want to bring you another cup of coffee. So then what happens is that the audience is subjected to this sort of helpless feeling of seeing the bad guy cheat over and over and over again. And even though it's completely scripted, it's soap opera, and I think a lot of them know that, it's the experience of seeing this injustice over and over and over again. And so then when the good guy gets his hands on the brass knuckles and brains the bad guy, well, they cheer for that because it's justified.
That's the myth of redemptive violence, the underlying cultural myth that supports our entire society and culture. That is that violence, the only way to overcome chaos is through violence, and you must meet violence with violence. And your example is a perfect example of the myth of redemptive violence. Hunger Games, perfect example. Avatar, perfect example. You see it everywhere. And it's a whole concept that we must use violence in order to redeem ourselves from violence and evil.
Well, yeah, and in professional wrestling, the whole story is violence. But, the way that I am trying to comprehend the fact that people in my family, like relatives of mine, on my Caucasian side, like the idea of voter suppression because they believe there's cheating. And I'll just mute myself because there's a baby crying. Oh, but then you're supposed to talk.
Oh. Okay, well, I mean, again, I mean, that the whole idea of voter suppression and all those issues, that's all about power. And people manipulating a system in order to, because it's fear, they're fearful. They're fearful of losing something, and so they gain what power they can around them, manipulate the system to their advantage, and at some level are trying to overcome a deep fear of alienation, abandonment, loss, whatever it might be. And that's the bottom of a lot of this conduct.
Well, this
you're
is how they
to
got
people
to
who
my...
are extremely prejudiced, and you're talking to people who are extremely fearful.
I don't want to say prejudiced. I mean, I'm talking about relatives of mine, and you know, we have our family has African Americans, Latinos, and Asian Americans, and Caucasian people in it. And this particular side of my family, this part of my family, has those things. And I don't know if it's prejudice, but the way they got to my aunt is over and over and over again on Fox News, they're telling her that Latinos who aren't supposed to be here are sneaking across the border, that black people who aren't supposed to be voting are voting anyway, that dead people who aren't supposed to be voting are having somebody take their voter registration card in and voting, and it's changing the outcome of the elections, and that's why we have President Obama, and that's why, you know, you said you couldn't possibly vote for anything that doesn't fit with the narrative of Fox News. That's the only way it could happen. It's because all of this cheating that has occurred, and of course there's the people on welfare. They don't deserve to have our taxpayer dollars going to feed their babies because they're just lazy. There's all of this cheating going on. It's, you know, it's pretty much constant. So when the time comes for voter suppression, there's actually a constituency that says, well, it's only fair, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I'm actually going to jump in here because I think it's important to point out, Eric, that that narratives take hold most rigorously, most firmly, when there are elements of truth under that narrative. And I'm not arguing for a moment that that Fox News hasn't blown this way out of proportion, but individual incidents of actual voter problems, and I can speak from personal experience here in New Hampshire, where there was a, I guess one can only call it a sort of a sting operation during the GOP primaries, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dead people voted. And I know this because the one town where they figured it out and stopped it from happening was the town that I live in, Bedford, New Hampshire, and that was only coincidence because there was a rumor out there that we should be on the lookout for it. So I would never argue that hundreds and hundreds of votes, as opposed to thousands or tens of thousands, is really going to influence elections. But these narratives begin from the genesis of truth, the genesis of events that are then dramatically blown out of proportion and allow these stories to be created. So I think it feeds the polarization. I'm interested in your thoughts on this, Doug. I think it feeds the polarization to deny on either side that there is some fundamental basis for where some of these fears and some of these ideas come from. They're not being manufactured out of whole cloth.
Right, and the sense that I get is that people are trying to create meaning in a very complex, ambiguous world. And so they will create stories like there's all this cheating going on. Well, there's all this cheating going on everywhere. Everybody's cheating. Well, that's a very simplistic way of dealing with the uncertainty, the ambiguity, and all the anxiety that uncertainty and ambiguity raises in people when they can't get their heads around the fact that that we live in a very gray place. And yes, there is cheating, but there's also huge amounts of honesty. And there are no simple explanations for why things happen. But for a lot of people, that's the only way they can make sense of it. And so that breeds conflict. And so what we really need are skilled people to get in and help people work through that by asking gentle questions and getting them to see the complexity of it and seeing if they can accept the complexity of it. And oftentimes I find that at an intellectual level, people are willing to accept the complexity, but emotionally they're incapable of it because it's just too overwhelming for them. And so they revert back to this very simplistic meaning-creating process of saying they're all cheaters. All welfare people are bad. You know, all Latinos shouldn't vote, because when you make these big, large, grandiose statements, you're soothing yourself. You're soothing an anxiety that you have within you, that the world is too complex and it's out of control. And that is the basis of a lot of conflict.
Go ahead, Eric. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to ask, what do you say? What do you say to a person who's seen the professional wrestling show and then concluded, you know, essentially their argument is that these individual acts of voter fraud, you know, as I understand it, more rare than shark attacks and lightning strikes,
right,
clearly aren't going to influence the outcome of an election. But it's good fodder for soap opera to make people feel like they're being cheated. And then to react by having government use systematic measures to remove people from voter rolls based on their surname or the impression that they might be, related to a felon or you know, Latino or whatever, to use systematic measures at the level of state government, that would influence the outcome of an election. I mean, how do you make the case that even though apparently your team is the one that suffers from the one vote per election cycle of, you know, a dead person voting or whatever, it's your team that's hurt, that it's a little bit of an overreaction to remove 20,000 American citizens who deserve the right to vote from the rolls? I mean, how do you get them there?
I think you really need to, you need, it's always contextual, all right? So there's no easy answer in the abstract, but the technique is to ask questions like, all right, if there were a perfect system, what would it look like? If you were to design a system where it minimized cheating, it wouldn't eliminate it, but minimized it, and where it was fair for everybody, what would that look like to you? And what would the system, how would you implement the system, and what would you do with it? In your mind, what would be the fairest way to allow everybody to have a voice in governance? And is that something you're interested in? And so you start getting people to think about solutions rather than about problems and see what they come up with. And if they're resistant, you know, at some point in time, they start finding that they contradict themselves. And they see that, and you bring people around. It's slow. And it's one step forward, two steps back oftentimes.
Let's take a step, though, into a little bit more of, as far as politics, frankly, a little bit more reality-based, right? So we have tens and tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars being put behind the effort to prevent exactly what you're talking about from happening.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
How do we get past that? I realize you're not the magic man. Brought you on, and you're going to solve the entire problem.
Get rid of our Supreme Court. Replace about five of our justices on the Supreme Court. You know, I mean, Citizens United killed us as a democracy. And there is no easy way to get rid of that. I mean, the structures have been put in place to allow for this high level of abuse, where extreme amounts of money can essentially, as you say, buy ideologies, you know, and that's the truth of the matter. That's the system we have, and it's hurting everybody. And the sad thing is that the people who are looking for less government and less intrusion actually have put into place a government that is even more intrusive, more adverse to civil rights, more adverse to liberty than any government in the United States we've seen in, you know, probably 4 or 5 decades. And it's the very people who seek minimal government and minimal intrusion are the ones who are responsible for deep intrusion of that sort of problem. So the only way I can think about dealing with it is to try to open up conversations with people, find out what their values are, and then ask them to look at the effects of what their simplistic ideologies are leading to. And I found in conversations with people that it's really quite amusing to watch people especially radical Republicans who, you know, who try to be thoughtful if you can engage them, who really become very uncomfortable when they recognize that, for example, the Patriot Act basically destroys the Constitution. You know, it makes peacemaking illegal, among other things,
which is
pretty interesting. But I mean, that's all part of the problem, and it's engaging people. Engaging them and having them really take a critical look at what they're really saying and the effects of what they're saying. And that's not happening, and that's the media's job, you know, to a large degree. And the media is not doing that. Doesn't have any interest in doing that.
Well, no, of course. The media is interested in selling tickets, essentially.
Exactly, exactly. And so there's no place, except for maybe shows like this, where people can come and learn and think and try to engage in what's really going on here, and is this really, really best for us all? Otherwise, it's just a soul peacemakers out there in the world, as conflicts come to us, engaging people at an individual level and helping walk them through the conflict to understand what it really means and try to make good decisions about whether or not is this the intended consequences that you wish, or are they unintended and not something that you wish?
So here's the irony we find ourselves in, is that the ends of the spectrum on both sides, although I will be the first to admit that it's skewed heavily to the right, the fundamentalist Republicans, as I refer to them, are far more organized, far better at messaging, and have raised far more money for their attempt at polarization than anything I've ever seen on the far left, certainly in current times. But we have you brought up Citizens United, which it seems like every Coffee Party USA show at some point. There must be a rule, Eric, where we have to mention it. It always comes up. We all hate it so much. But we've essentially instantiated polarization by making that money legal to do that job. And you mentioned the Patriot Act, which, you know, many people don't even know that Patriot is an acronym, and that the act itself has very little to do with patriotism.
Right, it has nothing to do with patriotism.
Nothing to do with patriotism. Well, it does if you read the narrative properly, of course. and you made an earlier point, which is very interesting. I read this in your book as well, that there's a section in the Patriot Act that actually makes it illegal to mediate if the parties involved in the mediation are people that the U.S. doesn't want you talking to.
That's right.
Considers them terrorism or
That's
terrorists
right.
or
25 years in prison. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So in a sense, they have what our society has done is formalize and instantiate the mechanisms to prevent effective mediation through money and law.
Right.
So where do we
go? I'll also say, just, you know, we were talking about taxes earlier on. We don't need to raise taxes. All we need to do is downsize our military. We spend, here's some statistics that really shock people. One thing, we spend, the amount of money that it costs to run the State Department on an annual basis is less than 30 days of operations in Afghanistan. The United States Institute of Peace, which is the only organization, only government institution totally devoted to peace, its annual operating budget is eaten up in 3 days of operations in Afghanistan. We spend trillions of dollars on military. When you account for all aspects of defense spending, which includes interest on the debt, we spend over 55 cents out of every tax dollar goes into defense. Just cut that back by 20 or 30%, and we have more money than we know what to do with.
Well, I agree it's an enormous number, but again, these things have to be done very cautiously, very conservatively, if I can use that word, because I'm sure you appreciate this, what many people don't appreciate about the defense budget is that tremendous amounts of that money come back to employing people in the private sector.
Absolutely, and all that tells us is that we need to move. I mean, if we're really going to be wise and build a sustainable economy, We need to suffer some short-term pain to reinvest this money and allow the entrepreneurial spirit that exists in this country to flourish without being dependent upon the tit of the defense budget. It's unsustainable.
I agree. I absolutely agree. I would bet that Eric agrees with you as well. But again, you know, we've got just a couple minutes left. I want to give you a moment to talk about your book as well. So, you know, in closing, I would like to kind of bring it back to, you know, what are, you know, the two or three things that, you know, Joe Citizen, Jane Citizen can do to make themselves more effective and more aware about the kinds of noise that are out there trying to prevent them from talking to their counterparts?
Well, it depends on how hard you want to work, because it is hard work to be able to listen to somebody with a polarizing perspective than yours and try to hold in your head at the same time your idea and a completely different idea. It's hard. And so it takes a lot of discipline and it takes a lot of rigor to be able to do that. If people want to do that, then, you know, exercise your brain. Exercise it and learn how to hold competing interests. Learn how to talk empathically to somebody who you violently disagree with. Learn how to connect instead of having a fear reaction and pull away. You know, engage with people at common where there are common values at a much deeper level than at the polarized level that political discourse takes in. It takes practice, it takes discipline, it takes a lot of patience, and it takes a lot of self-knowing, which is why it's so tough. I would also say that for the long term, take care of your babies. We can do more for this country by raising children in loving, nurturing environments than anything else. And to the extent that we're not doing that, we are breeding crime, we are breeding violence, and we're breeding further political discord into the future. The babies are the future, and we've got to take care of them.
I think
one way or the other.
An excellent point, I think that's a pretty good place for us to wrap. We do need to be constantly thinking about the next generation, whether it's today's politics or today's environment or today's international conflicts. We are going to leave that world to them. I think you're absolutely right. Doug, take a minute and tell people where they can learn more about what you do. I believe
sure.
that you have a website and also where they can find out more about your book and
right.
pick up a copy of that if they'd like.
The book website, which has my blog and a whole bunch of material on the book, including book excerpts and some book trailers, videos, is elusivepeace.com, elusivepeace.com. If they're interested in the Prison Project, that website is prisonofpeace.org, O-R-G. And I've got a bunch of other websites up on various other activities and interests that I'm involved in. You just Google Doug Knoll, N-O-L-L. You'll find out more about me than you ever care to know.
Great. And Eric, you had some final thoughts?
Well, my final thought is that essentially what Citizens United pays for is political advertising. And we also have a problem with political advertising disguised as news. But I think if we're all going to do our small parts, if we can somehow find a way to let people know that they're being marketed to, they'll look at the content with a different set of eyeballs, as we all do when we watch commercials differently than we watch the movies. You know, we just have to recognize that we're being marketed to, and hopefully some of the impact of Citizens United will be blunted by simply our capacity for free thought.
Turn off your television sets. You don't need them.
And on that note, Doug, thank you very much.
You're
for
welcome.
Being on the show. Appreciate it. It's Doug Knoll, the book again, Elusive Peace, How Modern Diplomatic Strategies Could Better Resolve World Conflicts. And you can find out more about Doug, his book, and his efforts at www.elusivepeace.com. That's it for this week, everyone. I want to thank you for listening to The Middle Ground. See you next week.
That's our time for tonight. Thanks for joining us, and please share your comments and suggestions with us at conservatives.coffeepartyusa.com, where you can follow The Middle Ground and participate in the 99% media. Our theme was written and performed by The Consultants and produced by Van Gabriel. Please join us again next week on The Middle Ground. Until then, be wise, be strong.